League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Hi, folks. Welcome along to this week's episode of Soundtrackin', our weekly podcast that celebrates the beautiful relationship between film and music. Just doing a bit of admin, really, and updating on various bits and bobs, and just looking back at some of the amazing guests that we've had just this year, for example. So maybe you've not had the chance to dive into our back catalogue, which features 400-odd episodes now. But this year, you know, we started off with Sofia Coppola, we had Jodie Comer, Daniel Kaluuya, Alexander Payne, Volker Bertelmann, Lorne Balfe, Martin Scorsese, Thea Sharrock, Max Richter, Denis Villeneuve and Hans Zimmer, Dev Patel, Alex Garland, Sam Taylor-Johnson, Amelia Warner, Joe Walker, Richard Linklater, Jeff Nichols, Andrew Scott, which was from one of our Soundtrack in Everyman film clubs, which we've got quite a few of those in the pipeline, about to unveil actually. We had a very last minute one that we did a couple of weeks back, and that is going to be a future episode in a couple of weeks, talking about this extraordinary film called The Substance, which was written and directed by Coralie Forget, and it stars Demi Moore and Margaret Qualley and Dennis Quaid, and we were so over the moon, is an understatement, to be joined by Demi Moore, Margaret Qualley and Coralie Forget for a live recording of Soundtrackin'. So that is coming your way in a couple of weeks, as is Kate Winslet, Andrea Riseborough and Kate Solomon talking about Lee. That's going to be a bonus episode this Friday, actually, because the film is out in cinemas this Friday. We've also got Jeff Goldblum and Charlie Covell. And we've also got a couple of extra exclusive episodes that are just going to be up on our YouTube channel. So we have a YouTube channel called Soundtrackin' Extra. And what we do is we tend to put up the visual versions of the podcast up there, as well as some exclusives. So we've got two exclusives that are going to be going up there. The Perfect Couple, which everybody's been talking about at the minute. It's a new series. It's up on Netflix. It stars Nicole Kidman, Liev Schreiber, Eve Hewson, Jack Renner. It has been directed by Suzanne Beer, who did The Night Manager. And it is one of those series that you're like, let me watch another one. It's based in Nantucket, and it's about this really super rich family, and basically the night before a wedding, a body washes up on the shore. It's a whodunit, and it's a very good one as well. It also features a brilliant dance scene that starts the beginning of every episode. Of course I asked Suzanne about that. So if you head to our YouTube channel, you can check out the exclusive conversation that I had with Suzanne. And also His Three Daughters is another beautiful film that is coming up on Netflix on the 20th of September. And I was lucky enough to chat to the writer and director, Azazel Jacobs, and Carrie Coombe, who plays one of the daughters in the film. And that is also going to be a YouTube exclusive. So yeah, loads of great stuff coming up, which I'm really excited to share with you. But let's get on with today's episode, shall we? Because sometimes what's really lovely on this podcast that I adore is that we get the chance to celebrate historical titles that are coming back into the spotlight. That could be for a restoration, could be for an anniversary. It could be just because we get the opportunity to chat to some of the creatives behind the film. So our latest guests on Soundtrackin' this week are director Ian Softley and musician Don Was, who joined me earlier this year to discuss the 30th anniversary of Backbeat. Details on where you can see it in cinemas at the end of the episode. The film stars Stephen Dorff, Ian Harr and Cheryl Lee, and Backbeat charts the early days of the Beatles and their pre-fame Hamburg days, focusing primarily on bassist Stuart Sutcliffe's relationship with John Lennon and photographer Astrid Kircher. Backbeat features no Beatles songs, but rather tracks they performed during their live shows in Hamburg. Now, Don produced these and also wrote the score, and we'll begin with an extract from his cue, "You Asked, I Came." as I was just saying to Ian, Don, to get the opportunity to celebrate this film, you know, a number of years after it originally came out is a real luxury, because it was a film when I originally saw it that really made an impact on me, particularly on, you know, on a part of musical history that, you know, I thought I knew about, but there was so much of it that I didn't. And the film told me so much as well. And getting to rewatch it as well in preparation for this was just, it was joyous. It really was. It was great. So congratulations again.
Thank you.
Ian, I'm going to start with you first before we get into Don and talk about the music and the purpose and the kind of the role and the character of the music and its different forms in the film. Why did you originally want to make this film and tell Stuart's story, really?
I was living in Manchester when I had the first idea. I was working for Granada Television, and the music scene was amazing at the time. Mm. I worked briefly with Tony Wilson. New Order were born out of the ashes of Joy Division. But there was loads of live music. I think I saw Gina Washington when I was there, and, you know, Adam Ant came through, and all the big bands, but also like the local Manchester bands. And as well as that, that there was a community of artists, you know, like playwrights, poets, and particularly musicians, both in Manchester and Liverpool. Some of them had been contemporaries of Stuart and John at the art school in Liverpool. I was looking for a story that was about coming of age story, about, you know, when people embark on that journey, which is full of risk and a tiny chance of success, really have to want to do it. You have to want to, you know, make your music or paint pictures or whatever else it is. And John Lennon had just died, and everybody in Granada was, including me, was kind of recruited to work on the obituary that went out that day, and the job that I had was to watch all the footage. And so I'd sort of moved on musically from them. I knew they were amazing, and, you know, they were original and geniuses and like responsible for so much, but I wasn't really listening to them that much. And so then, you know, I started to listen to them again and unearth things. And in the process of that, I came across a photograph of these two people. You know, this looks like a photograph that has just been taken for the Face magazine, you know, which was the sort of zeitgeist Bible at the time. And yet, why haven't I heard more of these people? They don't look like the guys, you know, the footage that I was looking at the Beatles, you know, when they started in the early 60s. And it was one of those rare opportunities that the more I kind of looked into it, the deeper I delved into the story, the richer it was. And it was like this treasure trove opened up. I knew I wanted to talk to Astrid and see if she was still around in Hamburg. And my route to doing it was, I'd heard that Stuart Sutcliffe's mother was living in Sevenoaks. So in those days, you know, you got the phone book out, went through all the stuff. I think the fifth person I called was his mum, went to see her. And through her, I got she only had a phone number of Astrid from, you know, years ago when she was married to somebody previously. I called him up and he was like, what are you bothering me? He said, look, I think she's running a bar in Hamburg. And he gave me the area. And again, I kind of did a bit of digging. And about 2 days later, I phoned up the bar. Astrid answered, talked to me a little bit, and was obviously a little bit bruised by the way that this story, you know, that people just wanted quotes about John Lennon's sexual activity, you know, was he homosexual, all this stuff, and not interested in her or Stuart or Klaus Voormann, you know, her boyfriend before. And she said, look, well, I said I was wanting to tell their story. I said, well, look, if you're ever in Hamburg, then just look me up. So I went over there.
Booked a flight.
Immediately went over there. Called her up and said, I'm here. And she laughed and said, all right, we'll come to the bar. And we spoke briefly in between shifts. And she said, look, come round to my apartment tomorrow night and we can talk at more length. And I turned up the next day and Klaus Voormann was there. He said, I told Klaus that you're finally telling this story. And so we're going to, we want to help with you. And it was amazing. He had Stuart's bass guitar that Stuart had given him when Stuart decided, you know, when Stuart left the band. Mm. But it was that photograph that it started with, androgynous. You know, they were dressed like each other. It was a self-portrait that she took of both of them in an early selfie. I'd just never seen the photographs of people from that era that were that cool, that confident, that sort of aware of their image and so artistic. everything about it. And that really thought, this is my story.
Wow. It's crazy to think that no one had tried to really tell it or to get to the truth of it before that. But I wondered whether, from having that wonderful insight from her, if that then informed how you heard the score or the music based on, you know, anything that came up in that conversation about the world that they inhabited as a couple and as, you know, kind of muses for each other, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was that there was the seed of the idea that really was the idea behind the music that ended up with us approaching Don. I mean, Klaus Voormann was her boyfriend before Stuart, and Klaus, I don't know whether they were parting anyway, or they were very kind of, you know, they were very progressive, they were very bohemian. And Klaus loved Astrid, but knew that she had fallen in love with Stuart. So he remained friends. They all remained friends together. And in the story, as we see in the film, Klaus, I think they'd had an argument. Klaus went into, you know, down to the red light district, heard this music playing, walked into this club, saw these guys, and he said it hit him like nothing. And he's a musician. I mean, he was classically trained. He became a, you know, very successful bass player. He played with John Lennon on Imagine, was in the Plastic Ono band. And he said it wasn't like rock and roll only. It was like punk with dance music. And it hit you in the chest. And he said Stuart's bass was amazing because it was this driving kind of like dance bass guitar. And I think Pete Best as well, he didn't have that kind of versatility of Ringo Starr, but he laid down a really, really driving beat. And Klaus was into jazz as well. So what happened was they were introduced, you know, I always think it's that ingredient that it was the two things that created the alchemy. It was the black R&B, Little Richard, Chuck Berry, were like thrashing out these songs every night, getting better and better and better and better. But through Stuart, John, and eventually the others were introduced to this bohemian world that was a European influence. So you had the American influence of rock and roll, and they were into beat poetry and Jack Kerouac. And not only was it a European art, but it was the way that Astrid and Klaus and their friends lived their lives. They kind of lived their lives as if it was an expression of their ideas. Mm. So they created their digs and they went to parties and they played the music, and it was kind of like happenings, I guess.
It's quite Warhol-esque, you know, in terms of that whole kind of like New York scene, but in Hamburg.
The European, you know, Jean Cocteau, they're really listening to Jean Cocteau, kind of black and white. Again, it chimed with my idea that it wasn't really a story about the Beatles that I wanted to tell. And I think that's why this story hasn't been told, because the Beatles are almost like this huge magnet, you know, will drag you towards them. And I wanted Stuart and Astrid to be the stars of the movie, and John, in a way, to be a groupie. And so they were the center of it. And I didn't want to have lookalikes for Beatles, and I didn't want sound-alike music. I wanted to try and recreate what Klaus and Astrid had said, that it was like punk. So I didn't want, when we put the band together, I didn't want to have a sound that was trying to imitate that. And so quite early, all of us, you know, the two producers, Finola, Steve Willey, Nick Powell, sadly departed, and Bob Last, the music supervisor. I think Bob said, look, the way we'll get the best band that's going to, you know, kick ass like that, like they did, is to get somebody that everybody wants to work with. And so we came up with some candidates. And then famously, anybody who knows Nick Powell will realize this is a classic Nick Powell moment. He was on the loo. And he ran out with his magazine. He said, we got to get Tom Waz. So we asked Don, and that was one of the great blessings of this story, was that Don said, yes, but I want to do the score, which was another blessing. And of course, everybody at that time wanted to work with Don.
Don, what was the appeal for you? Why was it something you were like, you know, because the two sides to this, you know, in terms of creating this version of these songs, but then also blending everything together with this score that's got such a character and presence in the film as well.
It was kind of right up my alley. I grew up listening to jazz and listening to the Beatles. I'm younger than they were, but not that much younger. I'm old enough to remember the Beatnik era, and I have always kind of regretted that I wasn't 20 at that time. I couldn't do much when I was 12, but maybe it's more romantic for not having been there. I don't know. Maybe you found the same thing, Ian. I don't know. But it just seemed like I was born to do that gig. I was thrilled to get the call.
What was the starting point? Where, you know, what? Where did you jump off from in terms of, you know, working on these two projects for this one story, really?
My first notion was I had just finished working with Ringo on an album and had played some gigs with him. I thought, well, I better check with him first, make sure this is, you know, that he's behind this. And he was like, I'm not in the movie. I don't care. Go ahead. He said, but he said the same thing that Ian learned from Klaus, which was, he said, but if you're going to portray him, don't try to make it sound like the early Beatle albums. They were nothing like that. He said they were like a raw punk band. Jumped up on speed, and there was all this incredible energy to the thing, and make sure you capture that. That was then the same thing Ian said. So that just seemed like the way to go about it, and to try to cast it with great musicians who understood the milieu and came from that milieu.
How did you get them all together? I mean, I still think it's the best supergroup that's ever been created. And especially when you watch back some of like that MTV Awards, and I'm going to see Foo Fighters on Tuesday night at Cardiff Stadium. And it's kind of, you know, it's just like seeing little Dave, little young Dave there behind the drums again, way back. And it's kind of like, you know, and you know how much the Beatles means to him, sort of thing. So talk to me a little bit about kind of putting that group together, and it's casting, really, you know, in terms of how it's going to work, how each of them sound individually, what they're bringing. But as a collective, it's going to work.
When I look back on it now, I can't believe we got all those people in a room so committed to making this music.
I couldn't believe it at the time, Don.
I guess I just made calls. I don't actually remember making the calls, but everyone showed up and everyone was very excited about doing it and playing together. They all sort of knew each other. The biggest surprise, I don't know that any of them knew Dave Grohl. And he was still just a kid. I believe Nirvana was still going at the time, right? I might have my time. I think Kurt was still alive. And
yeah, they were, because Kurt Cobain, I landed with Stephen Dorff in San Antonio, where we did the press junket. There was somebody in tears from Polygram, who was the press woman. And she said, oh, my God, Kurt Cobain's dead.
So he was still in Nirvana, and he wasn't necessarily the focus. But when he came in and played, I was absolutely blown away by his drumming. I realized that even then, he was one of the best drummers in the world, and actually had a lot of sophistication that he may not have even realized that he had, you know, as a musician. He just had a deep groove, and he dug in to the pocket really deep, and he still does. I've played with him a few times subsequently. He digs in. It's almost, you know, it's almost alarming that the intensity at which he can play. I made the mistake of telling the band what Ringo said and letting them know that's why I hired them. I didn't really mean it like that's why I wasn't saying you're Neanderthals, so you're perfect for this. I was saying don't try to make it too sophisticated and forget what you know about Beatle records. Years later, I was talking to Dave, and he mentioned, you know, it really bothered me when you said that you got us because we were primitives. I was upset that, well, first of all, that he carried it with him for 15 years or 20 years like that, but also that I miscommunicated the point. I don't know if the others took it that way, but he did. But I was blown away by his musicianship. In fact, all of them.
Yeah,
great.
Absolutely.
Wait! Oh, yes, wait a minute, Mr. Postman. Wait! Wait, Mr. Postman.
reminds me of the other two, so Mike Mills and Thurston Moore, but also Greg Dunn.
Yeah.
Interested to know how they all clicked.
It just clicked. It was combination luck. And I knew Mike Mills. I knew he was a lovely guy and would be super cooperative. I talked to Thurston Moore at length about it, and I could tell he was totally into it. And I knew what his ethos was, and that he'd be perfect, have a perfect understanding of the thing. And Don Fleming, I didn't know. He was a lovely guy. It's exactly what you said. It's casting based on music. And then we got lucky on the personality front, and that they were all lovely guys. And it was 3 days. We did 5 songs a day. And we never did more than 2 takes of anything, as best as I can remember. It was usually a first
take. Wow!
So we'd listen to the Beatles play it in the cases where we had recordings of them doing it. And if not, we'd listen to the original, the Little Richard record or whatever.
Yeah.
And then just go out and do it. And they knew instinctively what to do. There wasn't a whole lot of, we talked through it, but just go out and play it and keep it raw.
You had so many songs. It was amazing. And I'd done some music videos while I was writing the script. I'd worked after I left Granada, and I loved filming music. I think the combination of film and music. I actually think the cinema is the best place, other than the recording studio, to hear music. I think it's the best, the biggest room, the best sound system. It's unbelievable about going to see movies in a cinema. But when I first wrote the script, I had this idea consistent with the idea of containing it. And pretending that this isn't about the Beatles, because I knew I wasn't going to get the rights to the songs, the Beatles songs. So I thought, this actually works. Not only are they playing the songs as if they're like a band like any other band, rock and roll band, but they're playing songs that appeared on some of the subsequent Beatles albums. And I know a lot of people who think Twist and Shout, Money, Mr. Postman are Beatles songs. But without having to get the rights to any Beatles songs, we had that progression. And I had a certain number of those milestones in the script from the beginning. Obviously, rock and roll music, because it's got the title line of the film. Got a backbeat, you can't lose it. Just let me hear some of that rock and roll music. Any old way you choose it. It's got a backbeat, you can't lose it. Any old time you use it. Gotta be rock and roll music. If you wanna dance with me. If you wanna dance with me. I got no kick against modern jazz. Unless they try to play it too darn fast. And change the beauty of a melody. Until it sounded like a symphony. That's why I go for that rock and roll music. Any old way you choose it. It's got a backbeat, you can't lose it. Any old time you use it. Gotta be rock and roll music. If you wanna dance with me. Long Tall Sally, I love their version of it. Twist and Shout, I knew was going to be the ending, because it was this almost like the phoenix, this cry of grief and defiance. And okay, we're ready. We're going to grab the world. Love Me Tender, a couple of other tracks that Stuart and Astrid had mentioned. But there was probably only 6 or 7 tracks in my original script, and then through subsequent drafts. It was quite late in the process. It was, I think we were already in rehearsals when we got the tracks. There was 15 tracks. And I can remember, the things that I hadn't thought of, like, 20 Flight Rock. And I can remember the AD, assistant director, saying, there's all these songs. I mean, we're not going to get them in the movie. And we haven't got time to cover them all. And I said, but they're, not only were the songs amazing, but the band were great by then. They were they were really owning their performance. So I know that it's going to be an exciting element of the film. I don't want to have been in a position where I think, I wish I'd got a bit more of that. I wish I'd had more. But the whole time I assumed that they would be edited down. I would edit them down. And actually, I saw we had a 30th anniversary screening at the Picture House in central London a few days ago. The way that I think that we get a sense of how they were immersed in the music and how all-encompassing it was, is the music is just almost constant in the first sort of half of the movie. And that was because Don handed over 15 tracks. Well, I just thought, I want to use as much as possible because they are going to drive the energy of the film. Ah,
It was a brilliant stroke on your part as a director to know that these guys had to rehearse and bond like a band. And most films get it wrong. I'd say almost all of them do. You enhance the excitement of the tracks 100-fold by the way you handled the actors, which was to get them to bond as a band, to get them to learn how to move like musicians. And by the time the cameras rolled, it fools me. When I watch, I was confused today.
Oh my God, yeah.
I watched the Please Mr. Postman video, which is just beautiful, but I forgot that it wasn't those guys playing. I was trying to remember Stephen Dorff being at the session, and he wasn't there. But you did a marvelous job of that, and it's so rare that people get the actual music performance part right in the film. It was brilliant.
Well, I know that I was talking to Bob Last, the music supervisor, and he said, oh, we got to get to all hang out and really worry about their guitar straps, you know, and which order they go on stage. And we came up with this idea of having them, because they'd learned the songs by the time they were being filmed, so that they weren't miming. They were actually shouting out the lyrics to sync up Don's soundtrack with the actors singing, because they're, you know, the muscles and the veins are kind of coming out of their necks, because they are. So they actually performed for us without the backing. And I had this idea that I wanted to be on stage with them, so that when the film starts, it's like a handheld camera, as if the camera is one of them. And so we come on stage with them. And then by the time they're getting more famous, we're more and more distant, and we become an audience member. You know, so right at the end, it's like I can imitate some footage that I'd seen of them. But they, you know, they really did become like that. And they would argue about, you know, okay, it's not in tune, or, you know, the amp's place, you know, because there actually was a live sound as well, so that we recorded as a guide track, then play. Just as an aside, my next film was a film called Hackers, Angelina Jolie's first role. And I took the lesson that Don's talking about from Backbeat. And there's a group of hackers, and I said, I want you to be like a cyber band. And so we put guitar straps on their laptops, and they hung out together like we'd rehearsed with Backbeat. And so that they were this cyber band, and they behaved like that. And I wanted them, you know, and it was the lessons that I learned on Backbeat. There's another irony, which is that we used not only American actors, Stephen Dorff and Cheryl Lee, which I kind of like that idea that they were the stars and that the ordinary guys were the Beatles, but also, you know, we had American musicians, whereas I reversed that on Hackers. I had English dance music, Underworld, Massive Attack, Left Field, Prodigy, Orbital. So that I kind of redressed the balance on Hackers by putting the English bands in.
Yeah, Ian Hart's performance in this film, I remember kind of seeing it and just kind of going, who is this? Because he's just extraordinary. And just the, and I was reading some stuff as well that Julian Lennon had said when he saw the film after his mum had said, you'll get to know your dad better from watching this film, you know, sort of thing. And that's such a lovely sentiment. It must have made you feel wonderful, the fact that from your script, your direction, but Ian's performance had kind of really given John, you know, a kind of, you know, he's almost like a stand-up comedian at times as well. That kind of, it's wonderful.
It was something that quite early on, I guess it was just a sort of the ignorance of, you know, being a lot younger, when I just got to make this film. And everyone was saying, how can you do it? How are you going to get permission? I said, I've got this way of doing it. It's not about them anyway, really. They are in it. And it's certainly about John and his relationship in that group, those two overlapping triangles. But I can do it without needing them, because they're not going to give me their permission anyway. But then as we got to production, obviously the whole legal side kicked in. And I had to, you know, annotate the script for the lawyers and show that this is what Klaus Holt told me, this is what Astrid told me. And I think Don was the first person to say that there was almost like a kind of an implicit stamp of approval by Ringo. And I think Billy Preston, you were working with at the time as well, who was playing with him.
Amazing. Yeah.
You know, not only that, for the premiere, which I didn't know was the premiere, I thought it was a screening. I was producing a Stones record in Los Angeles. We were doing Bridges to Babylon. And what I thought was a private screening in the evening, I asked Keith, I said, I got a split for a couple hours. You want to come with me and see this movie about the early days of the Beatles? So we went together to this thing. Turns out it's the premiere of the movie, right? And there's this red carpet. And I thought, oh no, I've taken Keith to... And then I sat next to him. And as soon as we sat down, I realized, oh no, there's a competition. This is the worst thing I could have done. He was enraptured by the movie. He sat there and loved it, and he thought it was a great movie, and he thought you captured the milieu perfectly.
Oh, well, that's really nice.
He said that's what it was like, and he really he loves the Beatles. But it turns out he really enjoyed the film.
But I mean, going back to what Edith is saying, it was such an amazing kind of stamp of approval from, it was actually Cynthia. And I can remember I was at the screening with Fanola, our producer, and Cynthia was not really predisposed to like the film because we hadn't contracted her. And we didn't think, you know, everybody told us, well, everything that we were doing about Cynthia was in the public domain. And we had Astor, we had Klaus, and we had the Sutcliffe family. So it was the press people who said, look, it'd be great if she kind of says she likes it. So I can remember, and she was not talking to us. She was in a bit apart with, she had a friend with her. And at the end of the film, didn't say anything to me. I think the press said, oh, she likes it, and she's going to come to the premiere tonight. And I can't quite work out how it happened, but that I might have met Julian at drinks before or something, before the premiere. And I was walking to the premiere, and he at this limo stopped, and the window wound down, and Julian handed me a copy of the Evening Standard, the newspaper, mm-hmm. opened of an interview with him, and the headline, you're going to meet your mother tonight, and then it's, you'll meet your father tonight. And it said in the copy that Cynthia said, you should come to the movie because this is what your dad was like at the time. And again with Ian, he didn't, and I didn't coach him at all or point him in the direction of trying to be like John Lennon. It was from the inside out.
Yeah, yeah. You feel that. You feel like it's his interpretation of it, but with so much kind of life to it as well, you know. It's wonderful. Before we run out of time, I want as well, don't just talk about the score, because the score is absolutely beautiful. I was surprised in a really good way as to what the score was, but it's just, as soon as it starts, you're there, and it's just got this lovely presence throughout the film. Talk to me a little bit what you were kind of writing to. Were you writing to their love story, their kind of, both in terms of those different love stories that are really going on within the film? What were the kind of inspirations for you in terms of creating that score?
Before we started it, I checked out what Miles Davis did for a film called Escalator to the Gallows. I think it's a Louis Malle film, and I think it might be his first film from the 50s. And it was a jazz score, and they went to a screening room, set up a band, and they looked at the screen and played. I mean, I'm not a film score. I'm not educated in orchestration or any of these things, but what I can do is look at something and try to play it. That's all I did. But it's just, I tried to get into the emotion of the scene and play something that corresponded. I just sat at a piano and worked it out. Then we went in and cut it. And we cut it two ways. We cut it as a complete song. Each thing is a complete song for the album, which could be cut up later. And then we played specifically the bit of music that fit the scene.
Thank you.
And a lot of credit has got to go to Martin Walsh, who was the editor. And I didn't know what I was doing. I'd never scored a movie. And he really made it work. I guess working with you, Ian, I'm sure he wasn't alone on the North Pole doing it, you know. But he was very talented, and he knew how to cut these things properly and make them sit in there. And I was always very grateful for that. There was something really nice about it being an art house film rather than budgeted as a blockbuster, which meant we had to do it and be done with it. And it had to be immediate. Even the band stuff, we took 3 days because that's what we were budgeted. If we'd had a month, we'd have taken a month. You know?
But three days, though.
You work with what you got. And I thought that was exciting because I felt this was not supposed to be too polished.
Terrence Blanchard is on that.
Oh, yeah. No, it's Terrence Blanchard, who really, I don't think, had been scoring movies at that point. Or if he did, he maybe did one Spike Lee movie or something. But we'd have to go back and check. But he's going on to win Oscars and everything, you know. And I didn't know him. We're good friends. In fact, we played in Detroit, my hometown. My new band played there at the Orchestra Hall. And Terrence played You Asked, I Came with us.
Oh, wow.
Which was really cool. I'll send you a clip of it.
Do one better, Don, and make sure you come to the UK to play, bring Terrence with you, and then we'll all come and watch.
Oh, that's a great idea, actually. We could do that.
I bumped him in New Orleans. I was doing a film called The Skeleton Key in New Orleans. Guys who were local New Orleans guys, and they took me like 24 hours. The first 24 hours I was there, they picked me up from the airport and said, right, you're not going to need your suitcase tonight. You're not going to need to go to your hotel. You're going to go back for breakfast. And we went to various places. One place we went to was a kind of black music club. And it was, maybe it was jazz, I can't remember. But they said, oh, Terrence Blanchard's over there. Introduced myself. And he was, took him a while to sort of like compute. And he went, oh my God. And because he's professor of music, or was at the time, at Columbia. And he said the two things that he lectures on are Mo Better Blues and Backbeat.
See, I didn't know that. Wow. That's very cool. Yeah.
It's one of the few great things to come out of COVID is that with this, like we're able to do today from different parts of the world, come together to have this conversation. Prior to COVID, it never seemed possible to speak to so many composers, particularly about film, because they were never part of the kind of promotional package that was being offered. For me, the most joyous thing to come out of that is that things like Zoom has allowed us to really connect. And we had Terrence on the podcast maybe about 3 years ago now. We would not have been able to do this today as well had it not been for that. So it's always nice to think of the positives out of negatives. And for me, that's definitely one of the positives out of that crazy thing that we all went through.
You mentioned Martin Walsh, the editor, amazing editor. And one of the great things was that I had, when I started at Granada Television, they hired a load of graduates to make short films. You could direct them, even if you weren't a director, as long as they were under 10 minutes and they were for local programs. And there was a corridor of editors. It was all on film. After a week, I was completely in love with the whole process of film. And one of the editors on that corridor, as well as Chris Gill, who went on to edit loads of things for Danny Boyle, was Martin Walsh. And he was a Moss Side guy. You know, we were like 21 or whatever it was. And we would go out and listen to music in the evening and make little films, you know, during the day. And Martin's got an amazing sense of music that you picked up on. And he was just so loved this story and this project. And you're right, he did place some of those pieces. And I think that what's really poignant about the way the score works in the film is the way that it's reprised at different moments. So yeah. I think the music that for when Klaus discovers Astrid in bed with Stuart is then reprised, or a version of it, at the end of the film.
Yeah, he's wearing my bathrobe. Yeah, we did it with strings at one point, and then there's a full version of it. Yeah,
it unifies it, and it enhances the idea of a journey.
Oh, guys, it's been so great to celebrate this film and to get you together to talk about it. It really, really has, and Don, I really hope you do get across to the UK to play live for us. You know, apologies that we've. Well, not apologies, but, you know, the idea that we could have half an hour to talk about both of your careers as such is it would be an impossibility. So it's just been lovely to kind of focus on this collaboration and this wonderful anniversary of of this film and people get the chance to see it again in the cinema, which is great.
Thank you. You know, I'm thrilled that we were able to focus on it. It was a great honor to work with Ian on this film, and I'm really proud of the result, and it holds up 30 years later, and I'm glad that people are still aware of it and thinking about it.
Thanks so much, Edith, and it's so great to connect with you again, Don, and
great to see you.
It'll be too long before our paths cross again.
I hope so. Hope to see you soon.
You guys take care, and thank you so much for your time. Thank you. From the score to Backbeat, that's He's Wearing My Bathrobe, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with Don Wass and Ian Softley. My huge thanks to Ian and Don for taking the time to talk to us. Also, producer Finola for getting that sorted for us. Now, there are a few screenings of Backbeat to be found at your local cinemas. So, for example, you can see it in Liverpool on the 19th of September and Brighton on the 25th. Of September. So if you get the chance, go and see it in the cinema. Also, you can of course find it on home entertainment formats if you can't venture out. Soundtracking, of course, available wherever you get your podcasts, but you can also find every single episode at edithbowman.com, which has a really good search function for you too. You can search by film title, you can search by director, you can search by actor, composer, all those kind of things. Also, follow us on your socials. We're at Soundtracking UK, and as I mentioned at the start of the episode, please head to our YouTube channel, Soundtracking Extra, for loads of exclusive and extra content. Next up, also, as I said, we've got a bonus episode with Kate Winslet, Andrea Riseborough, and producer Kate Solomon to discuss their film Lee. It is an extraordinary pinpoint kind of focus on 10 years of the life of photographer Lee Miller during the time that she went to the front line of World War II to just take some of the most important and powerful pictures of the Second World War. We're thrilled that we have Kate, Andrea and the other Kate to join us to talk about the film, which hits cinemas this coming Friday, the 13th of September, the same day our bonus episode drops. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.